Hello again. This is Leila Benitez-James, and I'm honored to welcome you to the Asymptote Podcast. I'm thrilled to be signing on with this amazing team spread out all over the globe as the new podcast editor. And I'm especially excited by this new opportunity after seeing the latest October issue of Asymptote, which, if you haven't already checked it out, is really a must read. There we have new voices from 31 countries and 25 languages, including an exclusive interview with International Man Booker Prize winner Laszlo Krasznahorkai, as well as Anita Raya's exquisite essay on translation, which you'll hear just a bit of today. There's also a brilliant and devastating open letter from Stefan Zweig, and fiction from Su Ching, along with Iceland's only Nobel laureate in literature, Aldor Laxness. Not to mention some amazing artwork, and really far too much more to list now, as I want to leap in and get to some of our featured poets. Well, here in Spain, where I'm currently based, one inconclusive round of elections led to another inconclusive attempt, and after tension and annoyance rose due to projected third try, which would fall over Christmas, they've decided to scrap the elections altogether. Now I've printed off and prepared my own ballot to send to my home country of the United States, which is entangled in its own particular brand of madness, and again, when these political seasons return, the theme of lies is the constant crop. Politicians lying, or being accused of lying, media machines lying, or accusing their counterparts of lying, the word springs up constantly. It seems, in fact, that whatever the country and whatever the political climate, poets and writers must return to this theme to untangle their respective histories. Now from there they often leap into metaphor, big, overarching metaphor. This is also found in abundance, as language has to open up wider and wider to receive these histories. In our October issue, Tang Qianxi brings us a translation of Tan Qile's A, The Birth of History, from Myths of the Tea Century. In this poem, freedom is the sardines in a can, still caught between ethics and laws, gasping desperately. Here it is in the original Chinese, read by the poet, followed by its English translation.
Tea世纪神话 A, 历史 诞生，撤退的空荡中，一个感冒的巫婆勾引了发烧的国王，狡猾的扑克牌散了一地，独独少了一张 Made in China 的红心 K。巫婆的扫把早已飞逝在戒严的白色天空，无人扫地，满地谣言。邪恶的水晶球。 卖弄的不是皇后的皱纹，是国王的新衣。历史搁浅，在雨后的孤岛上，我唯一的信箱有你最后的一封信。沙漠上的雨有绝迹的危险，有阳光的热和沙风的寒。 当雨沙混合，满地铺成一席流沙，热烈举办天体营，理想和幻想随地乱伦。这盛会中的所谓渴望，是圣人的渴，平民的望。我终于明白，自由是罐头里的沙丁鱼，即使开启，也不过夹在法律和道德中间，残喘。
A. The Birth of History. In the wake of retreating forces, a witch with the flu has seduced a feverish king. The sly cards are strewn over the floor, lacking only a king of hearts, made in China. The witch's broom flew long ago into a militant white sky. No one sweeps the floor, which is scattered with falsehoods. The diabolical crystal ball flaunts not the queen's wrinkles, but the emperor's new clothes. History is stranded on a lone, rain-drenched island. The only mailbox of mine contains your final letter. The rain in the desert is in danger of erasure. There is the heat of the sun and the chill of the dunes. When rain and sand mingle, a sheet of quicksand is spread on the ground, holding a conference of heavenly bodies. Idealism and illusion are fused in incest. This holy convention's so-called yearning is the thirst of saints and the gaze of commoners. Finally, I realized, freedom is in the sardines in a can, still caught between ethics and laws, gasping desperately. Even after the can was opened, what's more, the enemy breeds cats. These lines leap about, and if you read the rest of the poem as in the series, you'll see concrete images which refuse to be tethered wholly in the literal world. Instead, metaphor and personification take over as the vehicle for wrapping the mind around political tragedy and buried histories. Now, I don't want to make any kind of political manifesto here, but lies were also on my mind recently as I was working to translate a sample of a slim novella. I was going along on the initial first draft, just trying to get a sense of the sentences in Spanish to get the facts. As I reached a bit of dialogue, I realized I had mistranslated something on a previous page. It said someone did something instead of didn't do. Something very simple. But when I went back to change it, it seemed that the text itself was wrong, was contradicting itself. When I returned to the dialogue, it finally hit me. One character was simply lying to another, and I had believed them too. The extent to which we get wrapped up both as readers and translators is unpacked beautifully in Anita Raya's Translation as a Practice of Acceptance, translated from the Italian by Rebecca Falkoff and Siliana Milkova. Raya explains that a text tethers readers tightly within its web, even if, when we read a book we love, it is difficult to tell where we end and the characters begin, where we submit to the author's will and where we impose our own. To translate is to accept this inequality, to see the text clearly and to willingly let ourselves be trapped in its web. A text that inspires our admiration, that influences us, gives us the feeling that the writer has articulated something for which we had no words. While reading, we have the impression that the text grants us voice, that if we know how to write, we would write it exactly as it is written, that the writer seems to have written it with us in mind. The act of translating must accept and amplify these impressions. To accept that the other's word is stronger than one's own is to search for a way to overcome the distance and bring original and translation together as closely as possible. To translate my text, then, I needed to see the whole of this web. I needed to be able to give to the reader both the lie and the truth of the text. This got me thinking about trust and about how we as readers interact and trust the characters we meet in our novels. How we engage on the page with deceit and misinformation. It got me thinking about my own little narratives and lies, both little and large, and how the lie is really just a genus full of different species. We have the outright lie, or the bold-faced lie, the little white lie, the lie of omission, the polite lie. There's a little lie of omission I have only recently begun untelling. For 10 years now, I have loved baking madeleines. They are a favorite, and I even travel with my madeleine pans so that I'm able to make them wherever I go. When sometimes asked what brought on so specific an obsession, many guess that I am an extreme fan of Marcel Proust, and that this affinity for his cookie of memory stems from a passage at the beginning of Swan's Way in Remembrance of Things Past, after the character takes a bite of a madeleine with tea. This is from the C.K. Scott Moncrief and Terence Kilmartin translation. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses, something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origin, and at once the vicissitudes of life had become indifferent to me, its disasters innocuous, its brevity illusory, this new sensation having had on me the effect which love has of filling me with a precious essence, or rather this essence was not in me, it was me. I had ceased now to feel mediocre, contingent, mortal. So how could this not have been my inspiration? And when asked outright if my love of Proust inspired me to make these cookies, I would most often offer some non-committal remarks about the books being amazing or iconic, without getting into the details of my actual reading history. And the actual truth does circle back on Proust in its way. When I was in high school, I saw the shoot-em-up thriller The Transporter, and was especially captivated by the heroine who, in men's jeans and an oversized white shirt, bakes madeleines. giving a nosy French police officer the illusion of a domestic scene so he believes our hero has put away his criminal past. We know the police chief has bought the ruse when he makes a small, appreciative toast to Proust, a detail which is quite strange and out of place for an action movie. So my small lie has unraveled, but it is based in a scene about lying, and not entirely unrelated to Proust's cookie. And doesn't a lie have the ability to evolve into a joke? If a reader can see both the truth and the written fabrication, can't it become fun, or even addicting, to follow the eccentric machinations of a wilder writer? Can't a lie evolve into metaphor, or perhaps, and more to the point, when does artistic untruth evolve into a metaphor? I think of the making of a 3D image and the layering of blue and red lines. If the reader is in the loop with the writer, they will be able to see both the lie and the truth simultaneously. Both the blue lie and the red truth can then overlap to create this 3D image, which is metaphor. To search out this transformation, I arrive again at the poetry section of our October issue. These works, though insanely diverse, housed a similar wildness which brought to mind Robert Pinsky's book, Leaping Poetry. Here were words skillfully rendered into English, which leapt well out of the way of truth and into metaphor. Take these six poems from the minimalist Iranian poet Rasul Yunan and translated by Siavash Sadlu, read first in the original Persian by Amir Malakai, and then in English by Sadlu.
با شعر و سیگار به جنگ نابرابری ها می روم. من دون کیشوتی مضحک هستم که جای کلاه خود و سرنیزه مدادی در دست و قابلمه‌ای بر سر دارد. عکسی به یادگار از من بگیرید. من انسان قرن 21 هستم. تابستان هندوانه‌ای خنک بود. قاچ شده بر سینی زور. آنها خوردند. ما تماشا کردیم. آنها ثروتمند بودند. ما فقیر. من و بهنام و مهرداد برای انتقام به این قفه‌خانه دور آمدیم. زندگی ما را زخمی کرده است. اما نه جیمز دین وارد می شود، نه جان وین. توف به این شانس. عصبانی می شویم. بغض خود را می شکنیم تا چیزی شکسته باشیم و بعد در رویاهایمان آتش می کنیم. اما تنها سه تا سیگار روی لبهایمان روشن می شود. هیچ خاکستری را ندیدم که بر باد نرود. جنازه تو نیز روی زمین نخواهد ماند دوست من. کندویی را که از رویای دیگران برداشتی سر جایش بگذار. نانی را که از دیگران دزدیدی با آنها پس بده. چیزی که از آن تو نیست، از آن تو نیست. به هر قیمتی زندگی نکن، نگران نباش. جنازت روی زمین نخواهد ماند. تو بمیر، ما دفنت خواهیم کرد. کنار دریا عاشق باشی، عاشق تر می شوی و اگر دیوانه، دیوانه تر. این خاصیت دریاست، به همه چیز وسعتی از جنون می بخشد. شاعران از شهرهای ساحلی جان سالم به در نمی برند. تو به بستون می روی، من نمی دانم کجاست، دلم می گیرد. تو به گاواتا می روی، من نمی دانم کجاست، دلم می گیرد. تو به هر کجا که من نمی شناسم می روی، دلم می گیرد. نمی دانم چرا فکر می کنم جاده های دور و ناآشنا در قلمرو مرگ واقع شدن. نمی گویم به سفر نرو، برو. اما به تبریز، به اهواز یا به هر کجا که بتوانی با اتوبوس های آخر شب برگردی. نمی شود به هواپیماها اعتماد کرد. آدم ها را به پرنده بدل می کنند و من به یاد ندارم پرستویی از بستون یا دورنایی از گاباتا بازگشته باشد.
With poetry and cigarettes, I go to war against inequalities. I am an absurd Don Quixote who, instead of lance and helmet, has a pencil in his hand and a saucepan on his head. Take a photo of me as a keepsake. I am the human of the 21st century. Summer was a cool watermelon, sliced on the plate of noon. They ate, we watched. They were rich, we poor. Behnam Mehrdad and I have come to this remote coffee house to take revenge. Life has scarred us, but neither James Dean nor John Wayne enters. Tough luck. We get angry. We break into tears just so we have broken something, and then fire up in our dreams, but only 3 cigarettes are lighted on our lips. I've never seen any ashes not going with the wind. Your corpse, too, won't remain on the ground, my friend. Put back the hive you stole from someone else's dream. Give back the naan you stole from others. What is not yours is not yours. Don't live at all costs. Don't worry, your corpse won't remain on the ground. You die, we'll bury you. By the seaside, if you're in love, you'll fall deeper. And if crazy, you'll go crazier. This is the sea's nature. It gives everything an immensity of lunacy. Poets won't make it back in one piece from beach cities. You go to Boston. I don't know where that is, and I feel blue. You go to Gabata. I don't know where that is, and I feel blue. Wherever you go, and I've never heard of it, I feel blue. I don't know why I feel that distant and obscure roads are located in the realm of death. I'm not saying don't travel, do travel. But to Tabriz, Ahvaz, or wherever else you can come back from on a late night bus. Trusting airplanes is a tricky business. They turn people into birds, and I don't remember a swallow coming back from Boston or a crane coming back from Gabata.
Yunnan's poems are at once so specific and so wild, almost tricking the reader with their familiar tone before dragging them further out to sea. A reader is similarly pulled into the web of Jan Damou's poetry, and what was particularly impressive throughout these translations was the musicality the translators were able to achieve, bringing us readers directly into their center. The walls of houses are close to you. The wind strews you in the streets. You merge with torrential waters, waters the size of adolescence and youth. Now listen to The Shade, also from Damou's 4 Poems series, which is both translated and read in the original Arabic, by Sunniya Mubayi.
قصيدة لجان دامو من ديوانه أسمال قرأتها سنيلة مبايا. الظل أمعن في صدودك أيها الواقع، فذاك قد يكون أولى بتمزيق النجوم. النجوم قدم تبحث عما يماثلها، قدم تورق مع الحلم، قدم تقطع. الفأس التي صنعت لقطع الجذوع ستظل فأسا دوما، آخر وافد إلى مملكة ذراعي كان يوم الثلاثاء، بين المطر والحقيقة يسقط ظل الله، ها أنا ذا في سبيلي إلى ممارسة إنسانيتي، الغرفة مربعة وكذلك القلب، مع آخر سجائري يتخذ القلق مكانه الأشد توحشا.
The Shade. Bore deeper into your aversion, O reality, as that might be more becoming for the ripping up of the stars. Stars, a foot in search of something that resembles it, a foot that sprouts leaves with dreams, a foot that severs. The axe that was crafted to cut trees' trunks will remain an axe always. The final arrival to the realm of my arms was on Tuesday. Between rain and reality, God's shadow descends. Here I am, en route to practice my humanity. The room is box-shaped, just like the heart. With the last of my cigarettes, anxiety reaches its most ferocious state. I descend. Part of the reason why these poems are so intoxicating is their ability to stretch their ideas out past the confines of the page. They are playful, even when dealing with weighty subjects. I remember, actually desiring to relive it now, a reading back in Houston back in 2014, where Anne Carson took to the stage, her bright red glasses frames hovering above the page she read. She announced she would be reading unpublished nonfiction, but what followed was a gripping story of violent gangsters and speaking crows, which fell well outside the bounds of what I would traditionally call nonfiction. The edges of genre are permeable, and the best writers make us question those boundaries and delight us in flowing past them. For our last peek into poetry from the issue, we have First Person by Xia Yu, translated by Steve Bradbury. To fully appreciate this piece, you'll really need to go online and look at the images which accompany the text. The poem hovers on the cusp of writing and work of art and sucks you in to several narratives. First Person, 20. Last time we met, we named all our favorite authors. We rattled off their names so fast that in no time at all, the only ones left were us. And when it was just you and I, we huddled by the heater, a fully furnished flat, including sheets and houseplants for 700 euros. Oh, the sheets were spotless, and there was a slanted skylight and snowflakes falling overhead. When I was young, I would have spawned in a place like this. 21. P.S. I think about those 400 lines pound cut from Eliot. What would have happened had they fallen into the hands of John Ashbery? Or if Pound had come back and began hacking away at Ashbery's work. John smiles at seeing Ezra wield his axe. Whole lines fall away like so many wood chips, and the air becomes perfumed, for it is first-rate wood. John scrambles to recover his lines, which, if you bothered to count them, would no doubt amount to 400. In their brand new order, they form a right and proper Ashbery poem, any line of which could well be a new beginning. 22. To never meet again is a pretty good idea. A good idea is quite enough, but putting it into practice belongs to a whole other sphere. A beautiful idea like this will give an impetus to poetry, the discovery of situationalism and the invention of distillation allows three or four people to share a joint outside a bistro. A bag of smuggled weed finally renders poetry's materiality a little more concrete. The trouble is this poetry has got to be better than the very best weed. What I mean is, it must be awful good poetry, or it's a total waste. 23. She said in music class, they have a silent keyboard for practicing your fingering. Your hands absorb the notes, store them in the loops and whirls of your fingertips, and the only time you hear them is when you caress. I can hear them very clearly. Oh, what a beautiful sound system. And that wilderness from which I hear a faraway echo in my body, is it not? I would like to say that it is that thing we call remember, but it is what we call forget. 26. I once heard tell of a postal worker who abandoned a big bag of mail he was carrying. He said that it was filled with nothing but bills and subpoenas, parking tickets, junk mail, and the like. The man became manically depressed, and the knowledge that no one writes real letters anymore. In short, because we no longer write to each other, he was carted off to prison. In a 24-hour laundromat, I switched to reading Dostoevsky. He'd have understood what it means to wash your dirty laundry with strangers. Oh, look, we've accumulated more metaphors to use. Now, no one will bother you, at least for a while. 27. That so many photos will be so lightly cast aside, I deeply sympathize with the disappointment of viewers. Like a cat in search of a cool and shady place to take a nap, who finds a place satisfying to its nap. Such photos don't pretend to offer viewers the sort of comforting imagery that gratifies their expectations. Might as well imagine a dying elephant that withdraws to somewhere nestled among the hills to await its final moment. The elephant leaves the herd and neither eats nor drinks in anticipation of its impending disintegration into the wild. Death, in the form of an elephant, hides itself away in order to mature and grow strong like any aloof and indifferent thing. I do not know if the sleeper passed away of a snowy evening because language is no longer inhabitable. 28. A cardboard egg carton filled with eggs fills me with sadness. You need a dozen babies one after the other to fill a single carton. Oh, I've come across Mary, come across her over here and there, come across her everywhere. Are you aware, I ask, that your baby will walk upon water? Are you aware, I ask, that your baby will rise from the dead? Mary, I said, will you look at that carton? Mary, why is your baby on that cross? Well, that's all the time we have for this edition, but you can find everything you've heard here and much more at asymptotejournal.com. And special thanks to our poetry editor, Aditi Machado, and our audio editor, Mirza Parikh. This has been the Asymptote Podcast. Until next time.